Why are grief and horror so frequently put together? Hi, my name is Marco and welcome to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast, the first one in 2024. So first of all, Happy New Year! It's good to be back and I had a great break, so I'm excited for everything that's coming. This time my guest is Laurel Hightower, an award-winning horror author. Her novella, Crossroads, won the Independent Audiobook Award in 2020 in the category of Best Horror, as well as This Is Horror Best Novella Award for the same year. Her other novella, Below, got a Bram Stoker Award nomination. She's also written two novels so far, Whispers in the Dark and Silent Key, and a short story collection, Every Woman Knows This. Laurel co-edited three anthologies and published many more pieces of short fiction. In our talk, we covered all of those, diving deeper into themes of grief, womanhood, and other serious topics that go hand in hand with horror. We also discuss her process, experience with traditional publishing, editing, and many more interesting topics. So, let's dive into this week's Storyline Session with Laurel Hightower. Enjoy! Hi Laurel, welcome to Storyline Sessions. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Marco?
I'm doing great as well. Thank you for coming out and being willing to talk about your work.
Absolutely. I appreciate the invitation.
For sure. So we could maybe start from your latest novel. I know the Silent Key was released in October. So how has the reception been so far? It's kind of a 2 months period, not long enough to get the full impression, but certainly the reviews are coming in. So how are you feeling about that?
I feel like I'm getting a lot of good reactions to it. I'm getting some not so happy reactions to it, but it's one of those interesting things where, are you familiar with Stephen Graham Jones? Have you read his work?
Yeah.
So I really love what he said. He said this on an interview I did with him years ago, but he said he doesn't ever like to do the same thing twice. He likes to do, you know, whatever he's done, he likes to completely pivot. And I like that because I feel like, you know, I think some of the people that don't love it, which is, you know, not everything's for everyone, and that's totally fine. They were expecting something based on having read Crossroads or Below, you know, one of my novellas. And then they're like, what is this? And it's a totally different setup. You know, it's very character driven. It's longer. It's got a lot more going on to it. So there's been some of that. And, you know, some people who were maybe expecting something a little bit different, which, you know, this didn't exactly, it's not, I guess it's, you know, in some ways it was like being compared to Jaws, and it's really not. So I can see why somebody, if they were, you know, expecting like something like that, it, you know, they wouldn't have really been happy with it. But what I've really been loving is the people that have been connecting with it have really, really connected with the characters. And that brings me a lot of joy because that's, you know, that's kind of mostly what I wanted out of it. I've been really happy with that. And my hope is that people, you know, the people who are going to dig it will find their way to it. And that the people that it's not for, I hope they find something really awesome to read, because it's so disappointing to read something that, that, you know, doesn't meet your expectations like that.
Yeah, sure. And think about the character at the center of it. This is kind of a blend of mystery detective thriller with horror, which is kind of an unusual mix. We don't see that very often. And I believe that when you have a strong character in the center of that, that's kind of make it or break it for a lot of people. And did you start from that? Was it the inception of the story? How did that look like? Because we will go back into your work and discuss other things you've done. But this switch and this different approach, how did it come to you?
Well, and it's actually, you know, like a lot of writers, my work has not been published chronologically in order of when I worked on it, you know, or when I started it. So Whispers in the Dark was my first novel. And that is not as widely known. It was my debut, and it's actually kind of similar in style. It's a novel, and it's got elements of thriller and some supernatural stuff in it. So in a lot of ways, Silent Key is kind of more a throwback to my kind of original type. So Silent Key was what I worked on after I finished Whispers in the Dark. So I just kind of really liked the aspect of creating, you know, this character who you know, I like a mystery. I love a mystery novel. But I always think that mysteries can be improved by throwing ghosts in the middle. So that's kind of just, you know, where that kind of comes from to an extent. And with how I started on it, though, was actually just, was fascinated with, I was reading a lot of things about, shipwrecks. I'm terrified of water. I'm just absolutely terrified of like deep bodies of water and, you know, what might be in there. And to me, like one of the most just intriguing but horrifying things is, you know, these shipwrecks are at the bottom of the ocean there. So you're in the ocean with all these critters and things that can touch you. And then you've got this sort of remnant of humanity that may or may not, you know, in the instance of submarines, you've got, you know, people in there. You've got people who've passed away in there, and a lot of times you're dealing with tragedy in this instance. And so it was such an intriguing concept, and I wanted to kind of explore it to an extent. And in a way it kind of started my husband. He is an expert on vacuum tubes of all things. So the little glass ones, you know, that they use in like amplifiers and like certain musical instruments, and they use them in CB radios. And so he mentioned the term to me, silent key, which refers to a CB operator, or ham radio operator who is no longer alive. They say they've gone silent. They're a silent key. And he was like, dude, that would make a great title for a book. And I was like, yeah, it would. And just kind of, so it was like a few little things coming together like that.
Yeah, that's a great story. And thinking about the underwater stuff, I also go on record talking about how I like that as well. And I think that's something that's still lacking in modern horror and thrillers, the underwater setting. We often go to space instead of going down under. But also the cover art, for me, it's amazing. And it's kind of an old school evocative scene, which truly, I think, speaks to that, as you mentioned. And how do you go about picking that? You know, because all of your cover arts are interesting and in their own way, they are not in the same style, but they are really evocative. But how did you go about picking the cover art for this?
Well, this one I had a little bit less input. I have found that the bigger the publisher, the less input you tend to have, which makes perfect sense. You've got whole teams of people working on that. So with this, you know, initially we just talked about concept. We wanted something to be kind of eerie and kind of like, you know, stuff out of sight and really focus on that sense of isolation that you have when you're underwater. Then beyond that, yeah, Flame Tree worked with an artist and they came up with a few sketches and, you know, my editor, Dawn and I, Dawn Doria, who's wonderful to work with, by the way, you know, we kind of talked about the options that we had and what we liked about this and that. So we kind of just narrowed it down from there. And then, yeah, that's, you know, I do think they really captured well that sense of just the, you know, the creeping isolation, just this, I don't know, this, the idea of being just alone in the water with only this small cone of light around you that you create yourself is just so,
Yeah, for sure, it works. And speaking of publishers, how's that been for you? You've been with a couple of publishers. How's that like panning out? Have you thought about completely going self-published? And what's your experience on that? Because a lot of people in this space are currently self-published. And did you think about like what are the next steps? And how was your experience working previously on your previous novels and short story collections?
I have been inordinately lucky, I feel like, in the publishers that I've worked with and the publishers that I have been able to, you know, kind of take the time to vet in that way, because I sort of a little bit, I go on vibes sometimes and I'm like, you know, these folks seem like somebody that works in my kind of style, you know, and because I'm an interesting mix, I guess, of being very type A about things like deadlines and, you know, completion and making sure things are like perfect as I can get them. And in other ways, I'm a complete just flake as far as like, you know, being put together, remembering to do things, you know. So I've really enjoyed working with people who are cool with that and to sort of, you know, are the same way. They're responsive, you know, and they're, you know, they have another good vision for it. I've really Enjoyed working with presses that are run by writers as well. Max Booth of Ghoulish is just incredible. And a lot of that has to do, I feel like, with him being an author first and him wanting to make it an author forward press. You know, he is very concerned about whether his authors are happy with the production. He's very inclusive in things like cover art, marketing plans, but he handles a lot of stuff for me, which is wonderful. You know, if he gets like a podcast or interview request from me that's for me that seems like really sketchy, he will run it by me and be like, hey, I haven't provided any information. You know, you take a look. And there have been times when I've been like, whoa, no, this makes me uncomfortable. And he never, you know, I never have to be in it at all. He's just like, And I really enjoy that. And Off Limits was very much the same way. I originally published with Sam Kolesnik when she ran the press, but I've been working with Waylon Jordan since then, and he's been awesome too. And I feel like it's, you know, it's very much the same way. It's like, hey, we're a small press. We're limited in some of the things that we can do, but what we can do, we're going to. And, you know, Red Legault, who has Death Knell Press, part of the reason I wanted to work with her is she's just a fantastic artist, too. And I was like, I want some of that art. So, yeah, it's been really great. I probably will never go the self-published route because I know myself. And I know that flaky part of me, that part that will just drop off on things that don't have like a flat out deadline, I would never market myself. I might never even push the publish button, you know, even if I figured out how, which seems like, you know, because I have lots of friends who self-publish and they do incredible work. And I have a really good friend that we go back and forth on it because he self-pubs everything and I don't. And he's like, well, you'd have more control and you'd get more money. And I'm like, I know, but I see how hard you work and I don't really like that. So I probably wouldn't, just in large part because I'm willing to make that trade-off of, you know, control and a little bit more in the way of funds to hand it over to somebody who does have a lot more experience with that and will actually stick with it, whereas I would just completely stop marketing myself entirely.
Well, it's great to hear that you have so positive experiences, because I know there are a lot of stories of people not feeling that way. So it's great hearing that there are people who respect you and your work in that way. And talking about the editors, you mentioned your editor. How does that work for you? Because you said you have a thing with deadlines. And how's that process been so far? And how did it change from your first novel until now?
It's pretty close to the same process I've always had so I always end up working, of course, with the editor that's provided by the publisher. And in some cases, you know, like, with Ghoulish, Max edits everything. Sam Kolesnik did most of the developmental editing. And then I think she hired a line editor for Crossroads. And then working with Flame Tree, that process has been great. I got wonderful developmental edits from Dawn, and there's another man who was involved in that. And then I got really good line edits. And that's part of it's like where the perfectionist thing comes in. I'm really militant about my deadlines. I want to meet all my editing deadlines. I want to get it early if I can. And then I am somebody who goes back over it with a fine-toothed comb, because typos will happen, you know, those kinds of things will absolutely happen. There's probably never been a manuscript published that didn't have at least something that needed to be fixed. But I am super meticulous. And so like my, you know, I do multiple last round read aloud edits, looking for little tiny things in the PDF to make sure that it's right. And so my editing assistant that I've been working with at Flame Tree is so kind, because like she'd be like, I thought we were done. And I'm like, no, I have 70 more changes, thank you. And she just rolls with it, you know, and I think hopefully was happy with the final product. So yeah, I've been really lucky in working with editors who are very keen in knowing the difference between authorial voice and not obscuring it, and making suggestions with respect to clarity and, you know, what's going to sound better and what's going to make sense. I really love the editing process. I love working with editors because I am, like every other writer, completely blind to, you know, the things that are holes in my work. Like, you know, you're so immersed in the work, you know the story front and back. So to you, it's like, well, of course he was there earlier. Duh, why don't you know that? Well, you never said it. You might want to. Oh, that's a really good point. You know, so yeah, I have been very, very lucky on that front, and really had, you know, folks who made very prescient and very excellent suggestions, and were, you know, just intelligent about the way they did it. So, yeah.
And being so meticulous and invested in the editing process, we could jump to the things that you were listed as an editor on. There was quite a few works you did editing, and at least in the part of the selection of the stories, we could go into that. The Dead Inside collection, that caught my eye. Could you tell us a bit about that process? How involved were you with the choice of the stories and the editing process?
And which one was that? Because I've edited three of them.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we could go for the whole tree. So maybe you could point out the differences.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. So I have co-edited three different anthologies. Two of them were charity and invite only. And one was an open call for-profit one called The Dead Inside that I worked with Dark Dispatch on. There's pros and cons to both of those. The biggest pro to doing an invite only is that when you have a lot of time constraint and you don't have time to read a whole bunch of submissions, you know, you're narrowing that down. In a lot of ways, I kind of hate it too, though, because I dislike being exclusionary in any way. And I know that in a lot of ways that can sort of perpetuate this feeling of it being a click. You know, that unless you have an in with specific people, you're never going to get a chance. But so both of those with, you know, with charity ones, I feel a little bit more like, okay, you know, we're all kind of doing this for free. And so I felt a little bit better about that. We Are Wolves was the first one I did. I co-edited it with Gemma Amore and Sina Palayo. And that was a wonderful experience. It kind of just, I had never thought of editing an antho, but it just occurred out of a conversation, you know, that occurred on Gemma's, I think it was her Twitter, about being asked to smile, you know, by men, and like this, like, you know, train of like, well, what's the worst time that happened to you? And we just wanted to do something, you know, that would maybe be positive in that space and let people have a voice in, you know, in discussing those kinds of things and how they made them feel. So that was really, really rewarding. I was so, so happy with the final product. Gemma did an amazing job with the cover, and Burial Day, you know, with Sina and Gerald did an incredible job with the final product. And it was just our authors. It is so generous for an author to contribute a story for free to a charity anthology, because that is their work. That's their blood, sweat, and tears. That's, you know, and especially in a case like this with the subject matter, they're telling stories that are sometimes very close to their heart. And the generosity of our authors in contributing that was just amazing. And then same thing with Shattered and Splintered, which was the one I did with James Sabata. That was a charity one we did for the event that he puts on, Spirited Giving. That one was to benefit the Stanley Hotel, the firefighters who saved the Stanley Hotel from the California wildfires in 2020. So, that was also very rewarding. We had, Scott Bradley, who is a firefighter and was for a long time. He wrote a story for it, which was just very, just eye-opening and just touching and huge. And yeah, I mean, that was an amazingly rewarding, project. And then, yeah, the Dead Inside was the one that, that was the one we did an open call submission on. We got like 620, I think, something like that. It was a lot. It was a lot, but it was also, I felt good about that because I felt like we'd come up with a theme that really struck a chord with people. It had to do with identity horror. It was, sort of the idea that, you know, this was during the time when the Black Lives Matter, riots were going on, when Asian hate was unfortunately a thing. And I was sort of observing people having conversations about how they maybe hid certain aspects of their ethnicity, of their culture, you know, to avoid certain conversations, to avoid being pigeonholed. And I thought about, you know, I'm a mom. And at that point, I think my son was only about two. And there's so much that changes about yourself as a parent, how people see you, you know, that kind of thing. And so I just kind of wanted to explore the idea of, like, you know, when you're put in a box that doesn't work for you, or, you know, when you have to put yourself in that box. So we got, man, again, people just really bled on the page for that. And I don't know, it is an exhausting, exhausting prospect to do. I would not have been able to do it without co-editors in all instances. Sandra Rutan was my co-editor for The Dead Inside, and she knows what she's doing. I would have been just floundering. So very, very rewarding, very, very time consuming though.
I can imagine. I mean, the teams that are tackled in each of those are really interesting and really important. And I think that ties in well with your own collection that Every Woman Knows. Every Woman Knows This, sorry. Mm-hmm. And I think that what you mentioned about men on Twitter asking you to smile and stuff like that and many more bad things, let alone just social media. But what do you think about those like works that tackle those perspectives and like the position generally of women in horror and like dealing with some modern times, but things that are, again, unfortunately timeless, people dealing with that. How do you go about it? I know that those teams are close to you, and I think you tackle them well, if I may say so, from my male perspective.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, but what's kind of a process when you go into that? You know, on one hand, you do need to cover those strong teams and have that voice, but at the same time, handling the genre teams and like crafting a story. So how does that process work for you?
I feel like the, you know, sort of the themes of being a woman in various aspects of my life, in various spheres, you know, whether it be in horror, in writing in general, you know, in life, in the state where I live, all these sorts of things, they are so intrinsic to who I am and my experiences that even when I'm not trying to write something that tackles those, I end up accidentally doing so. Below is a big example of that. I was really trying to write a straight creature feature, and I don't seem to be capable of doing that. So a lot of it has to do with just the way my experiences inform my writing. When I was starting to look at putting together a collection, I was like, I'm going to do an unthemed one because I don't, you know, and then I was looking at these, I'm like, oh no, I have a theme. Okay. Whoops. Everything I write is this exact theme. So, I feel like, and this is a wider view, I think, for myself and how I look at what I read, what I consume, and how I interact with it. The idea of the desire to read diversely, to read from, you know, to really make that effort to seek out and read and interact with media that's created by people from completely different backgrounds to me, is so just eye-opening, and it makes for an excellent reading experience. It makes for an excellent human experience, because I like to say that we know each other best through our stories. And where I'm a horror fan, like through and through, I think that it's so incredible. We learn so much about each other by knowing what scares other people, you know, because there are experiences like with trans authors that, you know, there are things that like the act of the necessity of using a public restroom in certain settings is a horror story all on its own. And that's something that I never have to think about. And, you know, some of the things that people of color face in instances that I take for granted that are perfectly safe for me and are not for someone of color. And also, I mean, things like, you know, toxic masculinity was not something that I really understood. And I'm sorry to say that when I was younger, I bought into a lot of the aspects of it. Oh, men shouldn't cry, you know, whatever. That's, you know, be a man, be masculine. That's so wrong, you know. And when you get older and you start to talk to people, you know, my husband would tell me, and some of the guys I work with, and also raising a son, you know, it's like you look at how intrinsic that is at just base levels and how incredibly destructive it is. And I just, the more that I read and the more that I listen and the more that I interact with people, I don't know. I know that it sounds a little bit like Care Bearish or something, you know, but it's feeling those connections and really getting them, just, I don't think there's anything more important than feeling connected to other humans. The more that we can do that, the more that we can open our eyes to each other and really see each other as people. I don't know. I think that's the best way forward for everything. So I guess in a lot of ways, it's like, you know, tackling those sorts of subjects in what I write. I have been really gratified by, you know, when people sometimes you feel very alone in your experiences. Some of them, like, you know, some of the themes I tackle have to do with fertility and pregnancy. And going through those kinds of struggles feels very isolating. But then when you kind of open up about them, you realize I have gotten so many private messages from people who have said, this was my experience. And reading this on the page was healing for me, you know, or I felt seen. I've gotten those kinds of messages from men who've been like, I didn't know what my wife was going through, or this is exactly what we went through, you know, and it felt like we were the only ones. There is nothing more rewarding to me than that, than to have someone interact with something I've written and to feel seen and feel part of something and feel less alone or feel, you know, validated. And I've also really liked, you know, because like I mentioned, when I was younger, I bought into toxic masculinity. I don't love that. I wish I hadn't, but we all have our blind spots. And I have had men who've written me to say, okay, I really didn't know that telling women to smile had this kind of effect. I've done it. I thought I was being nice. I'm going to really stop. You know, thanks for writing it. And I don't write things to be admonitory, to teach people how to be better. I don't write them to be like, this is why you know, you're failing and you should feel bad. It's more, I appreciate when someone reads it and goes, oh, okay, I didn't realize. And I don't know. I think that's just part of the ongoing conversation we have with each other as humans. So if I'm able to do that, it feels like this immense privilege. Sorry, that was an incredibly rambling answer.
No, for sure. I mean, it was a great point, and I think it's important saying that, you know, because we fortunately see a lot of more voices coming into the space, and we hear those things, and sometimes we take it for granted. I had a great talk with Zamil Akhtar. He's the author of a fantasy series, Gunmetal Gods, and mm-hmm. he's kind of, his work is Middle Eastern themed, and when we talked about, I asked him about his prose, because a lot of times in modern fantasy, the prose is pretty straightforward, not that descriptive, more action paced and stuff like that. And when we talked about his prose, he was like, for some things I need to describe the setting that doesn't evoke the usual things. For example, like Western readers, when they read, they went into a house, they envision a house as they would envision a straightforward medieval Europe fantasy house. But he's like, but my houses aren't like that. They look different, and things that are kind of are not set in medieval Europe as 90% of fantasy is. So I need to explain, what do you mean when I say a house? And for me, that was like, even like, I do enjoy a lot of diverse stuff. But when I thought about that, it was like, yeah, when I think about a house, I do mean like a classic house here described. So for me, that was also super interesting. And we do.
I love that. That was not something that occurred to me. It would not, but yes, he's completely right. That's, people are visualizing a certain specific thing. Alex Woodrow is, she's a great writer, and she also is the editor-in-chief at Tenebris Press, and she's from Romania. And she'll bring up these kinds of things all the time. You know, it'll be like, I think there was a conversation about when people say that someone frowned, and she's like, why are you guys drawing these emojis with the mouths down? Like, you frown with your like forehead, and like, it just blew everyone's mind, because we didn't realize, you know, like, some people think it's this and some people think it's this. And it's like, just having these cultural conversations are very like,
poof. Yeah, for sure. And I think that kind of we're seeing more of that, like talking about those topics. And for me, that's awesome to see. Like, of course, there are always people who will be, this is preachy, I don't like this, but you can change those people's minds. So I think it's still important talking about that. But another important topic, and something that comes up quite a lot in your work, is grief. And I think that's something that's kind of a, when we think about some of the modern horror, especially in movies, I think that's been prominent in the last few years. That's something they now call elevated horror, which is a term I know quite a lot of people don't like, but that implies that other horror isn't good. But like, one of the things that strikes that chord is Crossroads. And I think that that's something that, okay, is visible in The Silent Key, but is maybe front and center in The Crossroads. And when you think about the themes of grief, and especially as a parent. How do you think those translate in modern horror? Have you seen those tendencies, and why do you think they are coming up increasingly more in the last few years?
I think I feel like grief is something that is rife with horror in and of itself. And part of it is the process of going through it when it actually happens, you know, and grief can occur from loss of so many things. You know, it's not just like losing a parent or a child or a spouse or anything like that. There's grief for missed opportunities. There's grief for, you know, a childhood that was not how you would have wanted to be treated as a child. And, you know, when people with trauma grow up and they realize, like, you know, there's this grief for who they could have been, for the experiences they could have had. And I think in a lot of ways, that's why it's a pervasive subject now, is because it is something that happens. And it's something that informs a lot of experiences. And from a horror space, from maybe more of a trope space, when people are grieving, there's a sense of vulnerability. You know, when they're at a certain stage of grief, they are more vulnerable to promises by certain types of people, or in the way that I write, certain types of entities. You know, they're easier to prey on. They're more likely to make self-destructive type of decisions in pursuit of something that maybe is not obtainable. And I think it's something that, you know, a lot of us experience, and on the sheer enjoyment side of it, there's a lot of us that are like, you know, we listen to that sad music. I do. My husband is like, gosh, you have the most depressing taste in music. And I'm like, I like feeling that way, you know? And so some of us are seeking that kind of cathartic grief feeling. And so reading something that is evocative of that and then woven into the horror genre is, you know, it can be like really, really rewarding. Some of my favorite reads have been just dripping with grief. And yeah, I mean, it works to propel a story forward. It works. It's, you know, it can just be this sort of minor chord overall driving force.
Yeah, for sure. And when you think about like different authors tackling it, and as you said, that's different. That's a topic that's that ties in well with horror. And thinking about some works that are important in the horror genre, I know that a lot of people think that Pet Sematary is Stephen King's best book, and mm-hmm. it deals with loss, with grief, and it's one of the things that isn't quite out there as some of his other work, but people connect to it. And I think that's really something that's, as you well said, like not just loss of a close person, but something even more. And what's also interesting to me is that, like, when you think about grief and horror and seeing it in different media, is something that's tied in with a lot of kind of a work that's that sticks with people. I know that, like, even games such as Silent Hill, or like mm-hmm. a lot of people gravitate towards, as I said, King. There are a lot of short stories that tackle the same theme, and I think that's something that's often misunderstood with horror. People just tie into surface area of it and like talk about scary monsters, and as you said, you just wanted to write a cryptid story, but it isn't just that. So yeah. I just wanted to add on Crossroads, if I'm not mistaken, got an award for the audiobook in 2020. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That was interesting to me as well, because not all of your work has been translated into audio, but you've dabbled into that. So how was that process for you, and will you consider it going forward?
Oh, it was great. It was, again, it was one of these situations that where somebody kind of did all the work for me, which is nice. So yeah, I worked with, Fireside, and that was Joe Hempel, who, is a voice actor himself, had that experience for a lot of years. So for him too, I think he was very voice actor forward. He was very like, I want to give opportunities to voice actors. I want to treat them well. I want to come up with this great final product. And I think he really did an amazing job with that. Crossroads is the only one of my works actually that has been turned into an audiobook. There's talks on a couple of other ones. I hope to have more of that, because I would like it to be accessible, you know, to folks who have a much easier time with audio. And, you know, It's a different experience listening to it that way. So it was great because I didn't like, you know, go through and do the vetting on the audition tapes or anything, but Joe had, he narrowed it down to quite a few and then was like, okay, you know, what are your thoughts? And it was just hands down Linda Jones. When I listened to hers, I was like, oh man, that is the voice. That's the voice of the narration. That's the voice of my main character. She's incredibly gifted. And I knew her a little bit at that point. She is married to another author who's a friend of mine, John Foster. And so I was like, okay, am I being biased here? So I played them all for my husband without saying anything about who was who. And he said he was the same way. He was like, oh my God, that one, like hardcore that one. I was like, okay. So that was really rewarding because Linda did just an incredible job with it. And Joe did an amazing job with the final product. And I've been, you know, again, it's one of those things I don't typically listen to audiobooks. My, the way that my day runs, I have much more opportunity to read, you know, on the page than I do to listen to anything. But again, the more I do this, the more I realize how many people really connect better with those types of books. And, you know, some people it's a vision thing. It's a, you know, migraine thing. And from an accessibility standpoint, I'm like, man, I really want people to be able to experience it if they want to. So yeah, I really hope that we get to move forward with some more of those. And I would love for Linda Jones to narrate not only all of those, but my entire life. Like, she, you know, like I used to want Morgan Freeman to narrate my life, and now I want Linda too. So yeah.
Maybe it can be a conversation between those two.
Yeah. She probably has other things to do, but you know.
You never know. Yeah, but it's interesting that you say that you are more, you have more time for reading. I know a lot of people tend to go to audio, not to mention the people who have no choice or, as you mentioned, have the troubles with reading the traditional books. But a lot of people tend to go with audio because they have like different day schedules. They mm-hmm. like to do it when commuting or stuff like that. So it's interesting hearing the other side. When we're like, we've discussed your collections, the novels, and now you've also mentioned the novella below. We'll talk about that as well. But which is the form you tend to most latch on when you're thinking about your stories and when you get ideas? Which is the form that comes the most naturally to you?
I feel like the novella format has sort of, you know, my mind has kind of slid into that kind of length, that kind of storytelling style. I feel like probably 60 to 70% of the ideas I get end up looking to be about novella length. And I love working on novels for the time I get to spend with the characters, for the time that I get to spend, you know, just sort of like, well, part of it, honestly, is I love romance. I love romance. I don't want to shoehorn it into a story in which it doesn't fit. But if I'm able to include an element, and when I'm reading, that's always my favorite part too. You know, I love getting to watch these relationships form, and, you know, because love is this very central facet of the human experience. And it's just, I don't know, it's really enjoyable. And so with my novels, I feel like I get to explore that a little bit more. And in particular, the aspect of that that interests me is sustaining love. It's long-term relationships. I mean, I love watching a good movie or reading a book where people meet and you've got the initial falling in love stage, which is always so fun. But I also really love the love stories that look at somebody after, you know, couples after they've been married for 20 years or been together for, you know, or, and they've gone through things like having kids together, losing parents, you know, crises, that kinds of things. I love exploring the idea of what that kind of romance looks for, you know, looks like as we get older, as we grow together, as we, you know, as the relationship extends. So I feel like that's something that I really enjoy exploring with the novels. But there's also a part of me that's gotten real like instant gratification, you know, and so the novellas are much faster for me to kind of hammer out when I'm in the right, you know, mental space for it. When I've got something that's developed and ready, like I can usually bang out a novella pretty quickly. And yeah, there's a part of me that's like, nah, just get something else in print, you know, get that novella down, because it's a big commitment to start a novel you know, from the ground and work up. It takes me quite a while to get one on the page. But yeah, I feel like my go-to is novella, but I feel like if I had my druthers to work on only what I wanted to, it would probably be novels.
Yeah, and the first work of yours that I discovered was a novella, the Below novella. And I think that a lot of people did find you through that. I've seen a lot of YouTubers talk about it, and I think that's maybe because of the striking cover or something.
Oh, yeah.
That's responding with people well. But you were also nominated for the Bram Stoker's Award for that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So
could you tell us about that feeling?
That was a big surprise. Because, again, we were... And I'll preface this by saying this is not normal for me. Like I don't normally come up with something this fast, but I wrote that in about 3.5 weeks. It just, you know, just hammered it out. And I approached Max and was just like, I had the Spirited Giving thing that I was doing in 2022. So this was an event that my friend James Sabato was putting on and I was assisting with. And it was this, you know, like I was going to be selling books. And he said, James was like, you need something new before this. You got to get something out, you know, in print. So you have something new for people to buy. I was like, oh, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay. So, you know, I messaged Max. I was like, I would like to see if you're interested in publishing something by April. And he's like, that is very specific, you know? Mm-hmm. So we just like, but he ended up liking it. It's part of why I like working with him too, is because he's not afraid to tell me if something sucks. Like I don't ever want someone to publish something just because I want it to be my best work every time. So yeah, that one was, I don't want to say it was a lark because it's not like I didn't take it seriously when I was writing it and I enjoyed the story and the story really did mean something to me. But I was very surprised at the reception to it. Like you said, when you mentioned the cover, yeah, no, I mean, I will happily say that Trevor Henderson doing that cover is like minimum 30% of the sales, probably closer to 50, maybe 70 if we're being honest. You know, it's very eye-catching. And yeah, I do think that has had a lot to do with the number of people who, you know, the number of people it's gotten in front of. I think that's yeah, definitely got something to do with it. But yeah, the Stoker, Max and I were both very surprised by it because neither one of us, you know, campaigned for it or anything like that. And that's not to say like, oh, I don't care. None of this means anything to me. I mean, it does. It was, you know, I was like, wow, that's amazing. That's huge because it's this big recognition by your peers. You know, but yeah, like we both were just kind of taken aback when it made the prelim ballot. And then actually, I don't even think Max noticed that it made the prelim ballot. When it made the final ballot, I sent him a message and he was like, wait, what's going on? Then he went and checked social media. He's like, oh, this is why people are acting like we won World War III. Okay, I see what's going on here. So yeah, it was kind of crazy. But the takeaway from it again was that I really appreciated that many people had read my words, which I feel like when I started writing, I didn't think was going to be much of a thing. You know, I didn't know how many people were going to see what I wrote. I certainly didn't think it was going to be that many. And I certainly didn't think I'd ever be in a position where people would say like, hey, this deserves to win, you know, something or go down this road. So, yeah, that was crazy. Definitely not expected. Don't expect to duplicate it at any point.
Well, you never know. And for me, it's interesting that kind of we talked about themes that you explored and some of that ties in well with Below, but there's also an obvious kind of X-Files feel to it and cryptids. And it's not something that's super like present in your other work. You do mm-hmm. have some creatures and stuff like that, but it's interesting seeing this as well and kind of a... do you feel like going forward, is this something you'd like to explore more? What are other kinds of horror that you gravitate to as a reader?
Yeah, I definitely want to explore it more to an extent. I've never been a big cryptid person. I'm a ghost girl. I love ghosts. You know, you slap some ghosts on there, I'm all over it. And I love possession, those kinds of things. But Hunter Shea, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he is like the king of cryptids. He's a big Bigfoot Sasquatch guy, but he's written about just almost every cryptid you can think of, and he does it so well and so much fun. But he's also his best known book is called Creature, and it deals with this cryptid that I think takes some elements maybe of some existing cryptids, but really is something he very much created. And it's this complete and total gut punch. It's amazing. He's a fantastic writer. He's a fantastic writer. But this one in particular, when he really put his heart and soul in it, and I've read some other things of his, you know, where he does that too. And so I'm like, I just love that juxtaposition that he accomplishes. And I love that some of his books are like, this is really serious, I've got a story. And other times it's like, yeah, no, suck it, Bigfoot. Yeah. You know, it's so much fun. And I'm like, I really want to try to just be that fun person just the one time if I possibly can. So I'm good. You know, I'm going to try that one more time at least. And then, yeah, the rest of it, I learned a while ago to stop saying that I would never do something, because that then suddenly that's the thing that falls in my lap and I do next. But I kind of want to maybe dabble in horror erotica if I can. Like, I've got some friends who are doing it super well, and like, I very much like racist Presbyterian. So when I first was seeing this stuff, I was like, oh my goodness, you know, but then I'm like, wait, no, this is fun. You know, this is great. And so I've kind of wondered whether that's something I could do. And yeah, I mean, in some ways I just kind of want to flex my muscles on some stuff and be like, okay, you know, I've never written this before. I've seen other people do it a lot better. I'm not sure I can do it, but you know, why only do what I know I can do? You know, why not stretch my muscles? And even if I fail spectacularly, maybe, you know, if it's a terrible product, well, I just won't publish it. But yeah, I mean, I'll probably always stay pretty immersed in ghosts, that kind of thing, and character driven. But yeah, I want to try for some creature feature stuff. I want to try some erotica, and I might actually just write a straight up like romance novel, just because, again, I love that aspect. I really enjoy that part of it. I love exploring it. And yeah.
Yeah, for me, it's interesting seeing a lot of authors talk about how they're hesitant to switch up things too much because, you know, people expect something of them. Of course, you need to try to balance, like, not writing for the market, you write for yourself, but at the same time, some of your audience expects some stuff. And, like, thinking about writing a romance novel and things like that, would you use a pen name or would you just go forward and publish it either way?
My leaning would be to just write it under my name. Because everything I've done is horror, but within the subgenres, that's kind of a lot of range, you know, in particular with my short stories. I've written some straightly, you know, some comedic horror. I've written some splatterpunk, completely disgusting, grossed myself out kind of things. And, you know, I just wrote a grimdark one, which I didn't even know what that meant. I had to look it up. And then I was like, oh, I can't do this. And then I did, and I loved it. So I feel like my inclination would be to just write it under my own name and let people find it or feel how they want about it. I tend to try to be straightforward in interviews and, you know, what I say about things online, like, hey, this is this. So if you liked this and you hate this, it's, you know, don't mess with this one. Here's some other stuff over here. I am going to be querying agents next year. So if I'm lucky enough to get one and their advice is, let's try a pen name for that, I'll be open to exploring it. But I'm also, I talked to a crime writer, Ed Amar, I think it is. He's got several pen names, but he never keeps any of them secret. He's like, oh, hey, I just wrote this under this name. He's like, so it might be completely, you know, defying the purpose of this, but I would probably be that person. I'd be like, oh, if you want to read my romance, it's under this name. I'm totally the same person.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a category name. You put it on your website, and when you know which name responds to which category.
Yeah.
You mentioned splatterpunk. That's an interesting one for me. Did you, as you said, you gross yourself out, but how did you get to that? You read splatterpunk usually, or was it something you just wanted to try?
I don't read it very much. I have an iron stomach about some stuff, and other stuff I'm very squeamish on. There's a gross out contest that they do every year at Scares That Care, and I think they've switched it to doing an AuthorCon now that that's what it is. And I had some friends ask me to come in, and I lasted about 10 minutes, and I was like, I'm out. No, can't deal. You know, so there are people who do splatterpunk beautifully that I would never try to compete with. but I read it sometimes when it's written by somebody who's a friend of mine, you know, whose work I really enjoy or want to support. I don't know if Bo Johnson would call himself splatterpunk. He's more on the crime side of things, but he writes some disgusting kills, like some just, God, there's no line he won't cross. So I ended up actually, I don't know if I'm supposed to say it, but I'm just going to. He's doing an anthology of stories that are written in the world of his main character, Bishop Ryder, who's sort of this vigilante, you know, vicious dude. And so I was like, I don't know if I can do that. I don't write that way. And then I just wrote the grossest thing without trying to. I wasn't going to try to be gross, but I was like, oh, gross, Hightower, you're nasty. So I ended up writing that. And I don't know if I'll ever do anything like that again, you know, because I was just like, ew, that's really kind of, Bo said the same thing. He was like, that's gross. Good job. You know, so. Yes, splatterpunk is one of those things that I sort of often admire from afar, but
yeah, I mean, that's kind of a thing with the genre. I think it's a thin line between just being gross and actually being it in the service of the story. So I think it's a thin line that's often tough to navigate, but it can work out. So and thinking about other stuff you've written, just as you mentioned, you've written a lot of short stories, which at this point didn't end up in collections. What would you like pull out as something that people should give more attention to that maybe flew under the radar for a lot of people, but you really do like?
Oh, like an individual short story, maybe?
Yeah.
Or, oh man. This is really bad because this is where my flaky part comes in. I don't really keep a whole lot of track of it. There's sometimes when I'm like, oh, two, right? I wrote that. Yeah, cool. I have that story out there. I guess I might say, so there's one that's just funny to me that just amused me to no end to write. It was, it's called Give Me Your Fingers. And it is in an e-zine. I think it's called From Between. It's really bad. I need to like make sure I know the exact name of that, but there's some really cool stories in that, you know, that Matt has put together that are really cool. And that one just amuses the hell out of me. So yeah. It's Give Me Your Fingers. I think it'd be cool if people read that. Thanks.
And circling back to Below, I also seen that you wrote on Twitter that there were some piracy issues with that people tried to like even get money from it. So could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and I think that one may have ended up being a situation in which, because I looked into it further and talked to another author who'd been targeted by it, and we think that may be like a malware kind of thing where they were wanting people to click those links thinking they would get a copy of the book and that it was more targeting those sorts of folks. I have had it end up on piracy sites before. My feelings on piracy are kind of complicated because, you know, I would love for everyone to have equal access to literature, to I don't know that I really call what I write literature, but you know, words on pages. So you know, I would never go after somebody who was individually doing it. Like, I'm just gonna assume, you know, you don't have to prove to me that you're broke. Like, I'm just like, okay, whatever, this is part of it, you know. A site that attempts to profit off it is infuriating to me because I'm like, you're screwing over the people who are purchasing it. You're screwing over me because this is my intellectual property. I wrote it, and you're, you know, you're diluting my product. It's not right. It's not okay. But I don't spend a whole lot of time like looking for it. If it comes to my attention, I'll request that it be taken down. I'm a paralegal for my day job, and I mostly do litigation, but I also work for an intellectual property attorney. So I probably have a little bit more knowledge of that kind of world than just most writers do. So I'm able to be pretty targeted on things. I'm able to threaten with the appropriate words, you know. And so in that way, I'm lucky. I think the piracy thing, because I know my publisher Max, he has no problem with piracy. He's just like, whatever, you know, fine. People are doing it. That's cool. And I know some other folks that I really admire that feel that way about it too. And I think it's one of those things that it's up to the individual author how much it bothers them. Because some people are just like, hey, this is my work. You're not allowed to steal it. And it is theft. It totally is theft. But some people are more punk rock about it. And yeah, I think the main thing on it is that none of us need to be telling the other ones how to feel. You know, if someone's upset by it, then that's their property. That's their right to be. But if someone else is cool with it, they're not destroying the world and burning it down by being okay with making their own work available. So, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic because, as you said, people do need to have access to things. And I think that's really generous to provide people with that. But at the same time, you don't want people profiting from your own work. So I can imagine that can be tough. And it's interesting talking about your day job, because for me, it's always interesting hearing about different authors and what they do or what they did as their day job. And how do you feel that if in any way impacts your writing?
It's possible that I get some, I've never written anything that was based on anything that any case that I assisted with or read or anything like that. In large, you know, the biggest part of that is because it is, everything is confidential, and even something that maybe wouldn't be, I consider everything that I run across at my job to be completely 100% confidential, because I think that's what people should be able to expect when they work with a law firm. So it doesn't inform it in that way, but there are concepts, I guess, that I come across, legal concepts that wouldn't be known to me if I wasn't immersed in the field. And probably it's helped my writing. My goal is to always use the smallest number of words, like, you know, to write directly. That's primarily what I want. I want to write directly. I want it to be interesting. I don't want it to be cold and, you know, clinical and sterile or anything, but I want to get there, you know. And with a big part of what I do is I proofread the majority of briefs and things that are written by my folks before they're filed. And you know, a lot of times, like, they'll rely on me, like, being like, no, you don't need this part. This is repetitive. This doesn't make sense. You know, so I feel like in getting to do those sorts of things, it helps me with my own and being like, okay, this economy of words. Because, you know, with some briefs, it's like, you have X number of words, you're not allowed to go over that, you know, and it'll be like, okay, we're 200 words over, what can we cut? So I feel like it hopefully has helped some in, you know, in getting that more, like, I really enjoy the writing of Scott Turow. And, you know, he's an attorney, and he's actually, I don't think he really practices with it, but he is actually a member of my firm. It's a national, it's a worldwide firm. So it's not like I know the guy or anything, but yeah, I mean, I really enjoy that, just very succinct, to the point writing. So yeah, I mean, hopefully it's helped in that sense. And then, I mean, on a more general level, it's really, I think what affects it is that job more than probably any other that I've had, gives me the headspace to write. I have worked jobs where there was so much stress involved with it. I, you know, took it home with me every night and woke up with it every morning, and I couldn't write. There was a job I worked for 2 years. I couldn't put a word down. I was too stressed. And with this job, it's, it can be demanding. I feel like I've gotten to develop some skills, you know, that make me feel like I'm really contributing something. And I love that. That's a perfect for me. But at the end of the day, I go home and it's out of my head, you know? And so I feel like that's been probably the biggest benefit of that job on that, has just been like, I get to go do something interesting all day, and then I get to completely forget about it.
Well, it's great hearing that. And circling back to your work, you've announced a new novel that's coming in the 2024, The Day of the Door. That's an interesting title, and quite a chilling cover, if I may say so.
Oh my God, right?
Yeah, it's really something else. So could you maybe give us a glimpse into that?
Yeah. Well, and the cover, again, is Trevor Henderson. He is so talented, just so talented. And that is not a cover I will be allowed to display in my house at all. My 5-year-old will absolutely not allow it. He's not keen on that sort of thing. But yeah, so it's kind of a, it's, I guess it's a little bit of a family drama in some ways. It deals with, trauma in childhood and in, you know, explores a lot about how that has affected the characters as they've grown into adults, how it affects their relationships, even when they've tried very hard for it not to, and then having to come back and face some of the issues that really scarred them in childhood, and explore some of even just the offshoots of it, like realizing how much it turned them into these people, you know, how much it influenced certain things about their life. And, but also sort of the aspect of, you know, these siblings who don't have a whole lot in common, but recognizing that having those initial life experiences together is sort of a binding thing. So, yeah, I just kind of wanted to explore to an extent, you know, the idea of it being, you know, how much memory is changed by things and an interpretation of, you know, hey, did this really happen? Was this mental illness on the part of, you know, one of the people who was involved, you know, or some spectrum thereof, which, and I hope I've been respectful on that front as far as mental illness goes, because I certainly never want to write anything that's like it's just because they were crazy, you know, without exploring the facets of that, you know, because I think that's something that I'm not really equipped to write anything definitive on. So, but yeah, it's kind of, I would say it's a family drama with a lot of horror elements in it.
That sounds interesting. I mean, it's first thing that comes to mind is a head full of ghosts direction.
Yeah. And it's not, yes, definitely. And I feel like maybe that's one of the comps I used, not in the sense that it's the same kind of story at all. But yes, as you mentioned, it's that Paul Tremblay is just a master of that, you know, ambiguous, like, what is, you know, this could really go either way, kind of thing. So yeah, sort of that. And I think the comp I used was actually the Mike Flanagan's Haunting of Hill House, you know, meets Paul Tremblay's A Head Full of Ghosts. And again, I don't think that it's necessarily similar to either story, but like, you know, the Haunting of Hill House, I really thought was interesting the way they handled that with the mother, Olivia, you know, and I don't know if everyone else interprets it that way, but like, to me, Olivia is a narcissist in that. She is a flat out, very clear narcissist. And that's an interesting thing to explore with somebody who wants to love their children and clearly does, but is narcissistic. So I'm not quite sure I got on the subject, but damn it, I love Mike Flanagan. So yeah.
And did you see his most recent work, The Fall of the House of Usher?
Yes, that. And that is a contender for my favorite. My favorite has always been Haunting of Hill House, but dang, Usher is, you know, it's just such a different type of story. But oh my gosh, especially, like, I loved it from just the opening scene. But that second episode just completely sealed it for me. I was like, oh my God, yes.
Yeah, he's in a row. For me, it's The Midnight Mass. That's
yes. Oh, for me. Midnight Mass is beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen that he's scheduled to, I don't know if it's official yet, but they're talking he'll tackle the Dark Tower from Stephen King. So that could be interesting.
That's like a dream scenario, I feel like, for Dark Tower fans, of which I definitely am. I would love to see that.
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, I wish that the movie was at least something that split into few movies if they decided to go this route, which unfortunately they did, but seeing that was kind of a disappointment.
Yeah, I feel like if there hadn't been that expectation of it being the Dark Tower story, it would have been a fine movie. It's just so different. You know, it really wasn't telling the same story at all. So.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the vibe was fine and the movie itself wasn't bad, but as a Dark Tower story, it fell flat. And
it did.
Before I let go thinking about Flanagan and those things, what are some other things that you've seen or read or played or whatever in 2023 that would you like to point out, but for some of your favorites?
Oh man, that's so many, but I'm always way behind on things. I almost never get to see stuff like right when it comes out, but I loved Nope. I watched that this year. I was totally blown away by it. I loved the sub story. And I've got finished watching that. And I was just like staring at the screen, like nothing I watch next could possibly measure up to this. But then I watched The Candyman, the newer Candyman. And I was hesitant to watch that because I love the 1992 version. It's one of my favorite movies. And oh my God, just knocked it out of the park. Those two are just fantastic chef's kiss movies that I just loved. Fall of the House Usher definitely was an incredible watch this year. I'm trying to think what I watched this year. The Invitation, I can't remember if I watched it this year or last, but it was a great, great Dracula retelling. Really powerful. Really enjoyed that. And man, oh my gosh, the stuff that I've read has just, this is an insane, insane time for horror. Just stuff that just, you know, damn. I read a novella called Agony's Lodestone by Laura Keating, which was just so different and creepy and eerie. I read The Ghost That Ate Us by Daniel Krauss, which was different from anything I've read and was just really just completely engrossing. Some of the stuff I've read has been for blurbs, so I don't think it's out yet, but Grass Hands by Kyle Winkler, I would say is more along the bizarro realm, but I just like, I got done and I was like, I need to talk to someone in depth about this for like 6 hours because it just hits, you know, on so many levels. I'm trying to think, yeah, I could probably go on forever because I do, I read a lot and I try to hit as much horror as I possibly can just because it's what I love. It's what I love to be immersed in, but we are just sublimely lucky right now, you know, to have access to what we do and to have all this incredible horror coming out. It's amazing. Oh, and I know that I'll probably sound biased because he is my publisher, but Max Booth's collection, Abnormal Statistics. Good God, that just, I mean, it's just, he's such a good publisher and he's such like a funny, like quirky guy that I think sometimes people forget the whole thing where he's like this unbelievably gifted writer and he just is. And that just like, just smacked me upside the head. It was just so good. It's really, really excellent.
Those were some interesting recommendations for sure. I mean, we'll put up a list and definitely my TBR is going to be growing.
It's, yeah, it's a hazard.
So yeah, anyway, Laurel, thank you so much for coming out and being a part of Storyline Sessions. I'm looking forward to your next novel and everything you put out, even the romance, even though I'm not quite a reader of romance novel, but I'll keep an eye out. And yeah, wish you all the best.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. This has been fun.
For sure. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Storyline Sessions. I hope you've enjoyed our talk, same as I did. You can find Laurel on her website and social media. I'll put the links in the description. If you're interested in topics of creative writing and storytelling in any kind of media, keep following Storyline Sessions, both here and on Instagram. My name is Marko Bogdanović, and I'll see you next week. Keep creating stories.